All right. I'm rolling all around the studio because I have a chair with rollers on the bottom and because that song just gets me up and moving every time I hear it. We got a packed show, so I won't spend a lot of time talking about my chair, all right? At the back end of the show, you're going to be hearing a lot of recordings from Bob Avakian today, a couple that are really important. He's the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's really important in terms of the world that we're living in today and what people are being called on to rise up to, okay? At the back end of the show, we will be talking with George Ciccarello Marr. He's a professor at Drexel University in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, actually. And we're going to be talking about resisting the fascist attacks on academics. And you'll hear all about that. It's a very, very interesting situation. And it's one that's really important today in terms of what's going on in the world. And as I said, you're going to be hearing a number of things that are coming from Bob Avakian. Okay, a couple of short things that actually set things in the right context today. And in relation to that, I'm very pleased to be bringing back to the show Carl Dix, representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party. He's in Chicago and has been in Chicago for quite some time now. And we're going to be talking with Carl about this summer, Chicago will become known for revolution. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Yeah. Never too often, man. Never too often. And this stuff is extremely important. Just this morning, when I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning, I'll have you know, me and the dogs. Just this morning, a new report came out. It was in the paper that more black people are packing up and leaving Chicago than ever before. And the system says that it's the cause of this is crime and a lack of jobs. And I think actually, and what you've been talking about is if you really dig into things, actually, there's a whole lot more going on in Chicago in terms of the lives of black people than this. So, Carl, let's talk about what is life like for the people in Chicago right now, for black people in particular in Chicago right now?
Well, for most black people in Chicago, they're living in what is arguably the most segregated city in the United States. And that means that they are crowded into discrete areas of Chicago, areas where social services are average in Chicago, where the schools are being run down and closed down, and areas where the police patrol like occupying armies. The unemployment rate is twice the level of the unemployment rate for Chicago. So that means you have people growing up in beat-down communities where legitimate ways to survive and raise families have largely been stripped away, and the educational system is geared to fail the young people. So this is the situation that people are living in, and this forces many people into, well, the informal economy, coming up with some hustle, legal or other, in order to survive, but also has people looking to the street life as a way to be somebody in a situation where you're told in many, many different ways, you're nobody, you don't count. Mm-hmm. So that's the situation, and it means that a lot of the young people get caught up in fighting and killing each other, and then other black people are kind of in a situation where they're in the midst of all of this going down. So that's what it's like to live in Chicago, and it's only been very, very recently that the covenants from neighborhoods, where in white neighborhoods, people who bought homes had to sign agreements not to sell the home to a black person. These have only been exposed and rooted out. You know, and these are legacies going back to Jim Crow segregation and black people moving out of the South decades ago, but they've only been widely exposed and begun to be torn up very, very recently. And even with that, you see the way in which segregation and white supremacy gets upheld by the authorities, because the city of Chicago literally created a fund to reimburse white homeowners if the integration of their neighborhood brought the level of their property value down. They literally created a fund with taxpayer money. So you're funding people maintaining their all-white neighborhoods at a certain property level and resisting integration. This has gone on forever here in Chicago, And it's still something that people are fighting against, and it's what people are caught up in. And it leads to a lot of this violence. It also leads to people looking for somewhere else to go.
Let me ask you this, Carl, before we get off into the somewhere else to go, let me ask you this, because there's a couple other questions. I mean, one thing is that as you're talking about, you know, the system actually says that they're putting forward some solutions, okay? And one of the more recent ones that they talked about is they announced sending federal agents into Chicago. And you've actually, you know, argued that this kind of invasion can only mean more suffering and death for people. You know, and I think it's important people to understand this because they're actually sending a whole new squad to beef up all the other cops and pigs they got in there. They're doing a whole new squad to actually be brought into the city to stomp down on people even further.
Yes, and they announced this right at the end of June that they're sending 20 additional federal agents. I call this an advance guard of a reign of terror on top of decades of savage oppression. And I call it that because the police are no solution to the problem of young people getting caught up in killing each other. They're no solution because the source of this, what creates the conditions that have young people caught up in this, is the system itself and the way that it operates. Because like Bob Avakian says in Basics, our young people did not take the jobs out of the ghettos and barrios across this country, including here in Chicago. Our young people did not wreck the educational system. The capitalist system and the way that it works did that. And our young people are caught up in dealing with the conditions that that creates. Then on top of that, what you have with the police are people who function like an occupying army with a license to hunt down, brutalize, and even murder black people. And we, some of the high profile that have happened here, like Laquan McDonald back in 2014, the way in which police came up on him and there were a gang of pigs there, one of them gets out of the car and shoots him 16 times. And then the other cops start suppressing the evidence, putting in lying reports to back up the cop who, of course, feared for his life. That case is still going through the courts. As that case was going through the courts and in the midst of the protests around it, Quintonio LeGrier, another young black man, gets killed by police who were called on 911 by the family to help them deal with their, you know, their loved one who was having a mental episode. And in the course of killing Quintonio LeGrier, a cop killed Betty Jones, a black grandmother, who opened her door to see what commotion going on outside in her apartment. Cops shot her when she opened the door. And the cops involved in both of those killings have already been exonerated. This is the role the police play. And in beefing up the police and in backing them up, they're actually backing up the spreading of terror, terror that has led to the deaths of two 17-year-olds in the past week in neighborhoods on the South Side, where the Revolution Club and the Revolution Summer Project here in Chicago has been going to work on getting youth out of killing each other and getting them into the revolution, because that's the solution to this horror of our young people killing each other and all the other horrors this capitalist system brings down.
I'm going to get into that in just a minute, but I have one more question for you that I think it's important for people to understand, because, you know, look, there's a lot of these, you know, a lot of liberals, including the Rahm Emanuel, you know, who's like, you know, he's riding the coat of that other famed liberal, you know, Obama. And, yeah, you look at this thing and he's up there and he's talking about the schools. And you remember the times when we were kids, man, and it was always that silly, just, you know, whatever slogan of, don't be a fool, stay in school. If you want a future, stay in school. You know, staying in school is being cool, all that stuff. And people in Chicago, and in particular, black people in Chicago, when you're talking about school, it seems to me that it's really nothing but a place where you're actually sitting in jail without chains and bars, but you're not doing anything. And then being offered even more dead-end responses once they get out of school, and including the fact that they're going to be forced to actually, it seems like with Emanuel's new position, they're going to be forced to actually consider things like, well, you can't get a job, you can't do this, go in the military. So let's talk about like what's happened with the schools for a couple minutes.
Yeah, the school system in Chicago is really geared to fail the youth. There have been school closings on a massive scale coming down here in Chicago, escalating year after year. And then at the same time, the education that the kids get isn't one that prepares them to think critically and to grapple with how to understand the world and why it is the way it is, let alone to try to transform it. Then you have on top of that the fact that if you're young and black, your chances of having a run-in with the law are very, very great. Somebody told me that they were doing a volunteer program at the Cook County Jail, and looking at the people coming in, it was kind of like a high school assembly. And there are a lot of people there in Cook County, in prison, who are high school age. Well, you can't be doing school if you're getting rounded up and sent off to prison. And a huge percentage of them are there because they can't make the money bail. So you're going to school, and then all of a sudden you're not in school anymore because you're in jail. And I was at a panel where a reporter from a local radio station who was doing a program where she was following a young man, a young high school student, through several months, and she thought she was going to follow him through to the end of the school year, and she ended up having to follow him through a month in prison because he got arrested for something that he claimed right from the outset he didn't do. But the bail that was put on him meant that he couldn't get out and continue his school, so she had to then shift her reporting to what he did for a month, what it was like to be in jail for a month, after which the charges got dropped because there was really no case against him. And she said this is an all too common thing that black youth run into here. So the schools are wrecked, and then you put on top of that the way that police are sweating the youth, and then the fact that there's nothing for you even if you make it through school, then you're really gearing the educational system to force people out because it's taking them nowhere. So it's really no solution to the problems that people are up against.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix, a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And this summer, Carl is in Chicago because this summer Chicago will become known for revolution. Carl's there talking about what's happening to the masses of black people in Chicago, what Trump is doing, what the authorities are doing, what the system is doing to black people. And it comes down to genocide, nothing less. All right, well, let's jump into this, because you argue that all of what's being done by the system, in many places you've argued, and I think I agree with you, and you know that what's being done by the system is the problem, and that the solution is very different in every way. You know, and you talk about that in terms of bringing that out to people. But let's talk about that, because on the one hand, you got the system saying that the problem is the people, and they're just the people, just like, you know, they need to be corralled up, rounded up, and who knows what, where, who knows who may be reading Hitler's little guidebook. But this is a very serious thing in relation to what's happening to black people and other oppressed people in this country, but particularly in relation to what's happening to black people. And now in Chicago, let's talk about that, this idea that what is being done by the system is the problem and the solution is different in every way.
Yeah, and let me just say that some of what I talked about in terms of education, in terms of segregation here in Chicago and how it was built up by the system and maintained and kept into existence are things that we've written about at the website revcom.us, and I encourage people to go there to get more deeply into it. But now let's talk about the system being the problem and revolution being the solution, because that's what it comes down to. And what we have right now, you've got the Trump-Pence regime in power and taking steps that are already impacting Chicago, because this thing about sending the feds to fix the violence is something that Trump's been talking about since his inauguration, and he has begun to do. Plans are being floated to take this as far as putting concrete barriers around the large black neighborhood on the south side of Chicago and the almost as large black neighborhood on the west side, bring in the National Guard to man those barricades and bring down basically a dusk to dawn curfew where people can't go in and out without the okay of the armed personnel from the National Guard. This is how far they're looking at taking this. There's the question of, what are people going to do to survive? with the legitimate ways being more and more disappearing and beyond the reach of people. This is what people are up against. And see, when we go into the neighborhoods and talk about getting into out of the violence, out of killing each other, and into the revolution, we meet an array of responses, including some people who are attracted to that and want to get with that and ask us about that. But they've got some big questions, one being, how would they survive? How would they feed their families if they weren't involved in whatever they were involved in, you know, whatever hustle they were involved in to do that? And the other being, how do we deal with retaliation? Because the code of the streets is that if somebody does something to you and yours, your group of folks, then you have to respond and retaliate. Otherwise, you look weak and could get overrun. And it literally is the case. We go into neighborhoods on the South Side and young people tell us, well, we've got 2 or 3 or 4 block radius that we can operate in, and we can't go across the street when we get to the edge of that radius. Like it's an international border and you're at war with the people on the other side of it. And we have to fight with people over this, that no, the people on the other side of that border are not your enemy. They are just like you in the same situation as you. And you all are getting caught up in exactly what the system wants to have you in. They want you fighting and killing each other, which makes it easier for them to control all of you. We have to get into with people that we don't need to identify with the system. We just had an anti-4th of July picnic here, and we had to fight with some people, including some people out at the beach where we were doing the picnic, that like, no, we got nothing in common with the system. We are not with this system. We shouldn't celebrate it and its greatness, because what is great about America was dragging African people here in slave chains. Was that great? Was stealing the land from the native inhabitants great? And we got into some very lively debates and arguments over that with some people who just came across our picnic saying, yeah, you know, you're right. And I'm not out here celebrating the greatness of America. I'm just taking advantage of the day off to be with my family and friends. And we invited them, well, come on over and meet some new friends here at this picnic and get with the revolution. And then at the end of it, when we torched some American flags, that made it an even more controversial point, but it was one that needs to be gotten into, especially right now with Trump threatening, frankly, nuclear war in North Korea, and this thing of like one of the avenues of a way, a legitimate, as far as the system is concerned, way to survive is to join the military. That's a big question among people, and not coming from the angle of they're so down with the red, white, and blue and patriotic for America, but it is a way to survive in a situation where there are no jobs and all the other conditions. So this is something that we got to get into, and we also have to say to people, we are not, you know, because when we talk about Trump and everything bad that he means for the whole society, including the torn up communities on the South Side of Chicago, people are like, yeah, but it wasn't so good before Trump either. They don't like Trump, but they say it wasn't so good before him. And we have to bring out to them, we're not trying to get back to the way it was before Trump. That's not our aim. Our aim is to go forward, and to go forward, we have to get rid of this fascist regime, because it will bring down a clamp down that is unimaginable in the horrors that it would mean for all of humanity. But we want to go through that to get ready and in position to make revolution, to get rid of the whole system, because that's the way we could bring into being a decent and better way for people to live. And we challenge people that they can become part of the leadership of making that happen. Then we got to get into whether or not that's possible, because a lot of people say, people in this neighborhood, they're just too far gone. They're too caught up in the drug dealing, in the killing. The phrase, they're too far gone, that's the phrase that we have heard from a number of people. The people in this neighborhood are too far gone. Or they say, well, start with the shorties. Go for a 10 and under, because The ones who are over 10 years old are too far gone. And we have to bring to them another Bob Avakian quote from Basics about how did you go from when these children were beautiful children to now they're considered monsters by this system? What created the conditions where people are saying that, and what would it take to get out of those conditions, and how revolution is a very crucial part of that being possible and that being done.
Mm-hmm. All right, Carl, we have a couple more minutes, and I wanted to ask you this. Where do things stand now, and where do they have to go? I mean, it's interesting because as I was reading some of the things that you've written, and I really encourage people to go to RevCom, to RevCom.us, and look at some of these things, because there's some very moving stories about what happens when people step up and the kind of struggle that people are going through, even as they start to come and embrace some of the things that you're talking about. But at the same time, there's other things that they get stuck on a little bit, like particularly, I know some of the stuff about, you know, women, and some of the stuff about, you know, other, you know, whether they actually can be part of this kind of movement you're talking about and still be set, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I thought about that, and I kept thinking about, you're bringing to people a picture of a whole new future. And the fact, not that this is a future that that's going to be imposed on them, but it's a future that they're actually an important part of bringing into being, of bringing to life and in reality. And a lot of that depends, you know, actually, yeah, with the, you know, and that a big point around how that's going to happen has to do with what you're talking about with Bob Avakian and what he's brought forward. But basically, where do things stand now? I'd really like to know that. Where do things stand now, and where do they have to go? Because this is actually fairly exciting and extremely important.
Yeah, I mean, here's a good way to get at where things stand, because one of the neighborhoods where we did one of our Revolution Summer rallies, people have been going into them, and we went in with a communique from the Revolution Club that says, we cannot stand aside with arms folded while the pigs carry out murder and are never punished. We did this in the wake of the cops who murdered Philando Castile in Minnesota, Sam Dubose in Cincinnati, Ohio, and Sylville Smith in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, being exonerated, all in the space of a week. And when we went into that neighborhood, we handed out whistles to people. And a lot of, especially the younger people, took up the whistles. 2 days after we had done that, members of the Revolution Club went back into the neighborhood, and the pigs were like just marauding through the neighborhood, pushing people around, telling them they couldn't hang out in the park, different things like that. And kids gathered up when the club came and started blowing their whistles. And it created a gathering of people. And here were the cops on one side, the Revolution Club and some masses on another, and a whole bunch of people watching. And the cops basically threw down a gauntlet, saying, you got to cut it with these whistles, and you all got to stop coming in this neighborhood. And after a brief standoff, two people from the crowd watching walked over and embraced the revolutionaries. And it tipped things in that direction, and the cops had to leave, but they said, we will be back. And no more free passes was their exact word. And in the week since, there have been a lot of cases of them coming in, grabbing people, pushing them up against the wall, handcuffing them, holding them for a while and letting them go. And then on July 4th, they raided a July 4th party, arrested people, beat them up, brutalized them, and then came back the next day, and the commander of that division apologized for the way the raid was carried out and said, I'd like to talk with you. And very bravely, the brother whose house was raided, who was holding the party, says, I'm not talking with you unless the media is there, because I want what gets said between you and me on record, which the cops refused to do. We're going back into that neighborhood. We're holding a community meeting this coming weekend, and we're going to call forward people to say, look, they are afraid that some of you all might connect with this revolution and stand up against the terror that they've been enforcing here. And see, they made it real clear to people, don't get with these revolutionaries. Let things go back to the way it was before these revolutionaries came into the neighborhood, which was the police brutalizing people, terrorizing people, and people feeling they had no choice but to accept it.
You got 30 seconds, Carl.
Some people are saying they don't want to accept this. So we're going to be having this meeting and taking this message of getting out of fighting and killing each other and get into the revolution. And let's not only do that in this neighborhood, but spread it citywide. And the results of what happens at this meeting are going to be reported on at revcom.us. I really encourage people to check it out because we are carrying out the proclamation of Revolution Summer. And this being a summer in Chicago of people getting out of killing each other and into the revolution.
All right, Carl Dix, thank you very much for joining us, man.
Thank you for having me on, Mike.
All right, talk to you again soon, man. Take care.
Bye.
Bye now. All right, we're going to hear a word from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And it's very much related to what Carl's just been talking about, as well as to the whole future of humanity. And this piece is called They're Selling Postcards of the Hanging. Check this out.
Back in the day, Bob Dylan began one of his epic songs, Desolation Row, this way. They're selling postcards of the hanging. They're painting the passports brown. I don't know what that second line, they're painting the passports brown, is all about. Someone suggested maybe it's the Nazis and Hitler, because brown was a color associated with them. But what I want to focus on here has to do with the first line. They're selling postcards of the hanging. In the ugly history of this country and all its horrors, selling postcards of the hanging, in particular, selling postcards of the lynchings of black men, was literally a pastime, a kind of social activity in which all too many white people took part for 100 years and more, even after slavery was ended. Take the case of Claude Neal, who was accused of raping and killing a white woman and was lynched in Florida in 1934. Not only did a lynch mob hang him, they mutilated his body in the most horrible and vile way, and parts of his body were taken as souvenirs. And that's not all of it or the worst of it. His lynching was announced in advance, and people came as if it were a picnic. It was even announced in the Associated Press News Service and went out around the country. Thousands of people, including many solid citizens, came in this picnic atmosphere. One interesting thing is people on their way to an American Legion convention stopped off to witness the lynching. And some people were angry that they got there too late. You remember the American Legion? That's an organization of veterans formed after World War I who supported every reactionary, aggressive war of plunder and conquest carried out by the American government, including the latest war on Iraq. Photographers lined up to take pictures of Claude Neal's body, knowing that if they got just the right angle, they could make a lot of money selling the picture. And yes, from photographs of his mutilated body hanging from a tree, postcards were made and sold.
On July 15th, join us in the streets to protest and demand the Trump-Pence regime must go.
Every day they escalate their fascist attacks on immigrants and Muslims, on healthcare and the poor, on black and brown people, on women and LGBTQ folks, on the media, on the environment, on the right to protest, on the truth.
We must not wait until it is too late. We must pour into the streets to say no, not just for ourselves, but in the name of humanity.
Never underestimate the power of the people rising up together with right on our side.
Be there and bring everyone you know. Saturday, July 15th, hashtag J15. Go to refusefascism.org for more details.
I'ma point a finger in a finger. like you. I know what you did and I know what you do. Flipping that news got the people confused. Abusing all the rhythm, leaving us the damn blues. Wicked while you're winning while the rest of us lose. Nobody knowing just who the f*** who. So I identify you. Those who know who.
That's right. Those who know who. And real quick, I want to let you know that piece you heard from Bob Avakian was taken from a DVD of his, a speech he gave many years ago, and it's called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. Now, if people have been following what's going on in academia, it's quite disturbing. And I recently came across a case that just knocked me back in my seat. And it had to do with my next guest. My guest is George Ciccariello Marr. George was actually hit for resisting the fascist attacks on academics, and he's refused to back down since he became the subject of this targeted harassment by the fascists. And I'm really pleased to welcome him to this show. George, welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be on.
Good. Well, let's jump into this, man. You were recently accused by Breitbart and various other reactionary sites and people of unacceptable behavior and leftist militancy. That's totally inappropriate for a college professor. Tell people what happened.
This goes back to December, and it goes back to a satirical tweet that I sent mocking this white racist, nationalist, fascist concept of white genocide. And what's really sinister, I think, about this idea is the fact that, you know, over the past 40 years, there's been this idea developed that on the one hand, the United States is a colorblind society. But on the other hand, what that implies is that anyone who's actually demanding equality is involved in some kind of reverse racism or actually oppressing white people. And so in this context, you know, in this broader cultural context, white nationalists, fascists, open Nazis have turned to using these sort of sneakier terms, what I understand to be Trojan horse ideas that play on a mainstream white understanding of white victimization as a way of covering the fact that they're actually white supremacists. So it's much easier to gain a mainstream following by saying white people are being the victims of all these policies than it is to say, you know, we are the master race. And so this is a strategic tack that the fascists have taken. And one of these ideas, a very crucial one, is this idea of white genocide, which I think for most of us is the height of absurdity, the idea that this is a real thing or any kind of threat in the world, that white people will be the victims of precisely the kinds of genocide that they have inflicted on the rest of the globe is really too much to even take seriously. And yet this is very serious for fascists. They think that white people are being slowly outbred, that they're being intermixed, that any kind of intermarriage is undermining the purity of the white race, and that all policies of cultural diversity are kind of enforced genocide on so-called white culture. Of course, there's no such real thing as whiteness. It's a political category. There's no white culture. There are sort of various ethnic cultures that are grouped politically under whiteness. And so this entire concept is absurd. But in mocking it, I became a target for these white nationalist groups that use Breitbart as a bridge to the mainstream media, to Fox News and to other kind of far right outlets that sort of maintain a foot in the mainstream, and created a campaign of pressure against myself, against my university in Philadelphia, all calling for me to be fired for being, you know, for being a sort of anti-white racist, which of course is not a thing.
Mm-hmm. And they also, as I understand it, they also were very careful to actually also attack your family and the people close to you, right?
Of course. And I got, you know, we're talking about hundreds of threats. We're talking about doxing. We're talking about the releasing of my family's home address. Photos, all of these things. And these are really, you know, these are really brutal kind of organizations. I want to be clear that when we say fascist, while that term can be used, I think, in a more broad fashion, I'm actually referring to actually fascist organizations that identify as fascist, as white supremacist, as anti-Semitic. For example, one of the main websites leading the charge on me was called the Daily Stormer. This is an anti-Semitic Nazi website. Recently, flyers were going up at Drexel, where I work, you know, about anti-white sentiment on campus and trying to get students to come, you know, to come hear about, fighting back against this anti-whiteness. And these flyers were put up by people associated with a podcast called The Daily Show, Shoah being the word for the Holocaust. So we're talking about some of the most fringe, dangerous, you know, fascist and Nazi organizations that were nevertheless tied via people like Steve Bannon to the Trump government, to the Trump administration, and to these other mainstream figures like Ann Coulter, for example, who are explicit white supremacists and yet maintain access, a very dangerous access to mainstream media. Fox News and these, you know, and these outlets are running the words of people who explicitly are identify with upholding whiteness.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about how the university responded to all this, to the attack on you from them. How did the university do in terms of standing up for your right to speak, man?
I think nationwide we've seen this phenomenon where these mob attacks are invented online. They're created by Breitbart, by websites like Campus Reform, organizations like Turning Point that are essentially spying on faculty on campus and attempting to create and manufacture controversy. This has happened a dozen times since it happened to me. We're talking most recently about John Eric Williams at Trinity College in Connecticut, who was just suspended for something, for posting something that was not even his, not even his own words. Kianga Yamada Taylor, who gave a commencement speech at Hampshire College and was targeted by Fox News, actually, repeatedly during four news cycles, and this led to death threats on her family. And these things are being manufactured by organized right-wing groupings. And universities, I think, have been very naive when it comes to the fact that when this is happening, they don't realize that it's actually an organized attack, not only on the individuals, but also on the university itself, because these are people that do not believe in the principles that uphold the university, even if they use these as an attempt to strategically stoke controversy. In other words, these are people who are attacking the university, and universities need to stand up and say, we don't cow to pressure from far-right organizations that are attempting to threaten our employees. And this is, unfortunately, was not the position taken by my employer. It's not been the position taken by others like the University of Delaware recently or Trinity College. I was sort of reprimanded in public. And what the effect of this was, really, unfortunately, I think it was an unanticipated effect by the university, was really to encourage more harassment. Because once you give into this kind of harassment and this kind of mob action, what you're saying is you've done something that works. And as I mentioned, the Daily Storm, or this anti-Semitic website, said, we did this. So we had a victory on this day because we managed to make Drexel University respond. And this is the kind of thing that universities, even just for their own sake, need to avoid at all costs. Because what we're seeing is that these groups are growing in power, and every victory makes them feel as though they can pursue more people and pursue people saying completely mild things about the Trump administration, like Kianga Yamada Taylor did, simply describing the reality of the Trump government, and somehow became the target of these kinds of attacks. And, you know, people need to understand this is a coordinated attack. It's an attack across the range and the spectrum of faculty, tenured, untenured, black, white, brown. The reality, though, is that it's been almost entirely people of color who have been attacked by these groups. And it's a really coordinated and organized attempt to root out anyone who is an anti-racist and to claim that anyone who is an anti-racist is actually an anti-white racist and therefore guilty themselves of discrimination. This is a really frightening precedent, because what it means for the ability of the right to intervene onto campuses and to drive out what little, you know, admittedly little, you know, critical thought persists on those spaces.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's dig into this a little bit more, because I was thinking about this last night, and the attack on you is one of many attacks that we know about. You've mentioned some already. And there is a question I think that a lot of people have about why there's such a heavy attack on academia. And then there's a follow-up question I'd ask you right after that, which is basically, you know, what do you see as being at stake in relation to these attacks?
I mean, I think regardless of whether we want them to or not, universities matter. And the very fact that the right is carrying out these attacks points to the fact that universities matter. I think on the left, sometimes we kind of write off the university for a whole range of reasons. I think there's this idea that students are a more privileged class, that, you know, that faculty are not particularly radical. And none of these things are strictly untrue. But we're talking about also a context in which people, you know, young people are being essentially blackmailed into accumulating unpayable debts and putting themselves into permanent poverty to get a necessary degree that won't even necessarily get you a job when they come out. So I think this idea that universities are sort of privileged spaces is really collapsing as the universities themselves collapse. And the reason the right is intervening in these spaces is because they think that they can win some victories there. And because they're using, like I said, this colorblind rhetoric to say that we're the ones being discriminated against. They're using this freedom of speech rhetoric to say that, for example, Milo Yiannopoulos should have the right to speak on a university campus despite the fact that, you know, he's not a student, not a professor, and is actually getting paid to go around and speak on these campuses. And they're attempting to use these, in very bad faith, use these elements to sort of stoke controversies, to say that actually, no, it's the left that's racist. Actually, no, it's the left that's against free speech and academic freedom. And they're doing so in the most utterly cynical ways. These are you know, and you'll notice very clearly that the organization's attacking myself and Kianga and attacking, you know, all these other people are not defending our rights to speech, right? They may defend a eugenicist theorist like Charles Murray or, you know, a fascist like Richard Spencer, but they're not going out of their way to defend the left voices on campus, because they actually understand quite rightly that this is a material struggle between left and right, you know, and we need to look at it that way as well. It's not as though we can stand up there and say that we uniformly support the right to anyone to speak wherever and whenever, because they don't afford us that. And because there's no reason that we should accept, for example, fascist intervention on campus, you know, racist intervention on campus. And we need to fight these things. And students have every right to use their speech and their organizing, their mobilization to shut these things down.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, I want to let listeners know that we're talking today with George Ciccarello-Marr. He's a professor at Drexel University in Philadelphia, and we're talking about the attack on him for daring to stand up and say something true about the various Nazis running things and the whole tide of fascist ideas and thought and popularity, actually, in the country coming up. And George spoke out against that and was pretty severely attacked on it. Now, George, the other part of that question I want to dig into still a little bit more. What's at stake? Everything you said is true. A lot of people are going to say, well, okay, but what's at stake? Why does it matter?
I mean, I think what matters just in a general sense is that this is a space that the right is attempting to accumulate power in. You've seen the development of powerful right-wing media and religious apparatuses that played a big role in radicalizing people that would eventually vote for someone like Trump, and have provided, what they've done is actually to provide an alternative narrative to explain what's gone wrong in the United States. For example, the fact that the Clintons, you know, in Clintonism, understood as a right-wing Democratic Party, neoliberalism, abandoned huge sectors of the country, you know, and these institutions, these cultural ideological institutions, as someone like Gramsci would understand them, stepped in to explain what had happened and to do so in a convincing way. Whereas we're out there trying to explain and give our explanation, provide an alternative explanation, not for how everything's great, but precisely for everything that has gone wrong, why neoliberalism is failing, why liberal democracy is proving itself incapable of actually resolving the contradictions that it sets before itself. And we need spaces to make those cultural ideological arguments. We need spaces to be able to interact with people where we can say, well, no, listen, you know, Trump is blaming migrants for the state of the economy and unemployment and wages, but that's actually just simply not true. That's a total ruse. And we need to be able to explain the ways in which it's actually, you know, the capitalist structures and imperialist structures governing the world that are creating these conditions, not the fact that we're competing, say, with migrants, or the fact that Muslims want to destroy us, or any of these other sort of explanations that the right is giving. And we need to do that in movement spaces. This is, the university is in no way a substitute for movement organizing, but so many people move through universities, and we're talking about public universities, private universities, really universities that impact, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of people. We need to be able to fight battles in to keep those spaces, not so we can simply educate people in better citizenship, but so we can actually interact with and create militants who are going to be able to fight this fight going forward. The university is one important space in which that's going to happen, in which that needs to happen. And that's why the right thinks that it can take it over, chase out the radicals, as it has done in the past, you know, if we're talking about the 50s and 60s, and attempt to, you know, to win this cultural war that they've been battling for so long.
Mm-hmm. One more question, George. In this era of Trump that you're talking about, with a bona fide fascist in power, these kinds of attacks are most likely going to continue and even increase for the foreseeable future. How do you see fighting back against this? What do you think is required of people right now?
Well, the first thing to understand is that we need to fight. I think this is really the shocking thing, is that you had, on the one hand, Democrats saying, oh, Trump's going to be a fascist, Trump's going to be a fascist. And as soon as he was elected, then they said, well, let's give him a chance. Let's see what he does, right? You know, and then Trump, after a couple months in power and under pressure, made some moves to accommodate himself to the, you know, to the very same policies that Hillary Clinton would be pursuing, for example. And I think what's being forgotten and what's being undermined consciously by liberal sectors is the need to fight, and the need to really fight, and the need to recognize that no matter whether or not Trump was elected or not, he's not a legitimate president with legitimate ideas. The forces behind him are the most reactionary and retrograde forces that need to be fought at all costs. And so I think the first thing to do is to be organizing, is to be, you know, is to realize that we need to fight and that it's going to be a fight, and then to look at the parameters of where that fight is going to come. I think defending the faculty on campus, which is, by the way, also defending students' rights to exist on campus and to have, you know, ideas, you know, that they, you know, that they want to, you know, that they want to hear on campus, and their own ability to organize. But we're also talking about fighting when it comes to police violence, which is going to continue. We're going to talk about fighting against the wave of Islamophobia and the wave of deportations, and doing so in a direct action way that allows people to organize, you know, self-defense structures in their own communities that allow them to resist deportations, that allow them to resist police violence, as you were just talking about with the previous guest, and to do so on a community level. And these are the kind of things that all need to be tied together. But we can't write off the universities and say this doesn't matter, because the right is very, very clear about the fact that it does matter. And unfortunately, you have too many professors and faculty that think, you know, that they live in a bubble and think nothing's going to affect them, or they have tenure or something. Well, you know what? I have tenure and I'm under investigation, and who knows what's going to happen. And even worse is the fact that most faculty now don't have tenure because the universities are basically attempting to proletarianize their workforce by hiring adjuncts and hiring people who hardly even make minimum wage and making them do all the teaching in a way that makes them utterly expendable if they ever raise their voice or if they ever say anything controversial, as we've seen. And so we need to create a united front across the universities as well, so that faculty, students, and everyone realize that this is an important fight, that it's not just a couple of individuals. As I said, there have been more than a dozen cases over the past couple of months. This is a unified, coordinated attack by the right, and we need a unified and coordinated response by the left.
All right, George Ciccarello-Marr, thank you very much for joining us today, and let's stay in touch, man. Keep up on this.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This is great.
All right, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Professor George Ciccarello-Marr from Drexel University, and George was attacked very severely by the administration of his university for daring to call out the fascists as fascists, all right? And this is something that people need to pay attention to. In fact, we got to pay so much attention that I want to run another piece from Public Enemy, from P.E., all right? It's from the same album, and it's called No Sympathy from the Devil.
Fit for rhyme, BS fit to spit. The hate produced, thrown up in a noose. Most them history pages come in all stages, colors, genders, and ages.
Devil.
Black, brown, yellow, red, but white. Supremacy, tendency, and currency. Estrogen, robbing my oxygen. Still dissing skin, inform my next of kin.
Get in the back of the car.
What?
Let's go.
Crazy.
All right, once again, that was P.E., Public Enemy. And the song was No Sympathy from the Devil. And once again, it also has the same message. Those who know who. And just keep that in mind, all right? Because you're going to have to know in order to know who. And once you know who, you got to decide what you're going to do. And along those lines, people remember The Clash talking about this is a public service announcement. And this time we got two announcements from Refused Fascism. In the second one, the voice that you hear at the end is singer-songwriter and musician Layla Hathaway. Now, you can go to refusefascism.org to find a protest in your area on July 15th. And if you hear this on a podcast or archive after July 15th, you can still go to refusefascism.org, because July 15th is only the beginning.
If you agonize and rage at what's being done to the people, the planet, and our rights, take it to the streets, July 15th.
Protest and demand. The Trump-Pence regime must go in the name of humanity. We refuse to accept a fascist America.
Be there. Saturday, July 15th. Hashtag J15. Go to refusefascism.org for more details.
I moved in here like a
You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab him by the
Must be a pretty picture you dropped
in. John and Dennis.
Trump uses an intern's back to sign a release form.
I could do this all day long.
No.
He is pandering to the most extreme regressive retrograde elements of the Republican Party.
And as you know, we're under siege.
I very much appreciate all of the hard work that Faith and Freedom have done, which strengthen family values, do all of the traditional things that we all love so much.
Do you believe in punishment for abortion? Yes or no, as a principle?
There has to be some form of punishment.
For the woman?
Yeah.
No. Women and LGBTQ people are full human beings, not objects to be grabbed, demeaned, victimized, and denied their fundamental right to control their reproduction and how they choose to live. No, we will not accept the cruel and brutal future of the Trump-Pence regime.
Stand up and protest on the 15th of July.
All right, and what I want to do now is I want to play yet another segment, a very important segment from Bob Avakian's talk, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About, which happened in the early years of this, of the 2000s, okay? And it was actually, this is an extremely important piece, and I think it really brings a lot to what we've been talking about. And the piece is called, and Bob Avakian is, for people who don't know, is the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and this piece is called What to the Slave is Your 4th of July from the Past to the Present? Check this out.
Frederick Douglass was a slave himself, who after he got his own freedom, spent his life fighting against the oppression of black people and other injustices. Invited to speak at a July 4th celebration, Douglass made clear that July 4th was nothing to celebrate, and that America was guilty of great crimes. Here's what he said about it. What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him, more than all other days in the year, the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty and unholy license, your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants are brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgiving, with all your parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes that would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this very hour. And Douglass also said, America may accuse others of savagery, but really it has no equal when it comes to this. He said, for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival. As the saying goes, truer words were never spoken. Douglass spoke these words while slavery still legally existed in the United States, but his comments apply just as much even after outright slavery was ended. And all this time, while all these lynchings and other acts of incredible cruelty were being carried out, with all the oppression they embodied and enforced, all this time, those who ruled this country, those who refused to do anything to stop these lynchings and other acts of terror and atrocities, those who were responsible for these and other barbaric crimes, all this time, they never stopped proclaiming, this is the greatest country in the world. This is the greatest country that has ever been. This is the leader of the free world. This is the homeland of freedom and democracy. It is not just that many white people acted like depraved beasts. And it is not that some were actually devils, although it certainly may have seemed that way many times in the history of this country. The deeper thing is that all these horrors were shaped by, they were encouraged by, and they served to keep in effect a whole system, a system that could not have existed without first slavery and then near slavery. And segregation and terror centered in the South while the great majority of black people lived there, chained in one way or another to the rural South and on white-owned plantations. White supremacy is built into the foundation of this country. It is something this system and those who rule it could not do without, even if they wanted to, which they don't. And this has continued down to the present. Despite all the false claims these days about how this is now a colorblind society, segregation and discrimination continue against black people and other people of color. Every time there is a study or a survey to determine this, it shows without fail that segregation and discrimination exist in housing, in jobs, in schools, in healthcare, in every part of society. And this continues to be backed up with brutality and violence.
All right, welcome back. That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's a clip taken from his talk, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About, which was given in 2003. And remember, check my Facebook page for links to the videos I played from BA, as well as the reports Carl Dix talked about earlier. All right, and I want to thank everybody who worked on the show today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op for today. Yeah, I almost lost my breath there. My board op for today, Kiana Williams, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. All right, and guess what? We're going to go out now with yet another piece from PE, because Public Enemy just has so much that's important to say and for us to hear, all right? And this one is called Praise the Loud. Talk to you again next week.
Bring that beat back,
bring
man.
That beat back. Bring the beat back.
Y'all want to hear that beat, right? Bring that beat back.
Yeah. Revolution. Revolution. Revolution.
Call me the trigger man.
Yeah. Revolution. Revolution.
Watch your step.
Revolution.
Don't expect revolution.